of the financials, and then we'll hear from the chief.
Yes. So police is the first yellow public safety tab. And as I think most of you know, the police program is 100% funded in the general fund. They are projected to end the biennium with 122 FTE, which includes a request for two new staff, one new lieutenant, and one forensic detective. They've talked about this in their budget narrative, but one of the kind of significant changes in their budget is an enhanced use of technology. So they've got tablets, streamlining some of their workflow, upgrading their radios, et cetera, to make their patrol operations more efficient. And then they also have continued support of the computer forensics and investigative technology tools. On the capital side, so they also have the five-year vehicle and equipment plan that's a couple of pages right beyond the narrative. You can see they have $540,000 of capital requested in the first year of the biennium, and then $184,000 in the second year. Most of this is replacements of existing vehicles. There's a couple of new vehicles in there, and then they also have $45,000 in their support services budget for a new shoot house, which they can explain. I think it's kind of like they have some movable walls and they can practice
shooting.
Clearing rooms. I've tried to let us go in there as like a finance team building with like paintball guns or something, but that didn't seem to fly. So that is their super high level, their personnel, materials and services, and transfers. You can see there's not, everything's pretty much status quo. Pending the results of their feasibility study. We mentioned this last night at the end of kind of the citywide overview. One of the kind of budget issues that we would talk about for police was implementation of their feasibility study, which I believe has been completed, but the report and analysis hasn't been finalized. So I can answer any questions on the numbers, and if there are none, I'll turn it over to the chief to go through their presentation.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you. Three long days of your volunteer time here. We sure appreciate it. Basically, we're going to present a budget that's going to address what we see as our immediate challenges. It's a little lighter strategic challenges because we're waiting for the feasibility study to come back. We've identified what is really affecting the livability of Bend and the direction we want to take Bend and what we want to do. We've incorporated some really strong software to help us get that done. Captain Paul Kansky is in charge of my investigation, IT, and he's lucky enough to get the budget also. He didn't know that before he promoted him. He's going to lead off with some of our basic comparables, the cities we kind of see ourselves in line with. We try to stay within the state to make sure we're within the same funding bracket, legal requirement bracket, same OARs, administrative rules, to make it apples for apples, though we did reach out to Sparks. So I'll let Paul go through that, and then I'll talk about some of the solutions we see coming up.
I need that here as a pick-up. So thank you for having us. I'm Paul Kansky with Bend. Our comparables that we've chosen are, there is one out of state, and that's Sparks, Nevada. They're kind of based on a little bit of tourist attraction, even if it's not the exact same as Bend, because we obviously are a very unique place. Sparks, Nevada kind of attracts that same type of thing with their outdoor life and their water sports and such. And I think most of you are familiar with Medford and Hillsborough. Those cities as well attract a lot of outside attention just based off their livability and function. The populations of those, 81,000 for Bend, approximately 76,000 for Medford, about 95,000 for Hillsborough, and 92,000 for Sparks, Nevada. So similar in size. One of the things, if we can switch the slide, is there somebody that, we do there, thank you.
I got it.
Turn of events here, this is the first one the chief switched the slide. this is the total dispatch actions by city. The dark blue has been there, and you can see the other city's colors represented. We had a slight decline in 2014. If you look over the last, even prior to 2012, we've averaged a climb still over the previous years. So we don't anticipate that that's means we'll continue to drop. Of course, we do have some programs that Chief will talk about later, and we may see some of those drop based on those programs, which would be a good thing as well. Probably the significant thing about this slide is when we go to the next one, I would say, is this is our calls for service per officer. So our calls are fairly consistent in the previous slide with those other cities, some of which are larger than us. And then our calls for service per officer are significantly higher. We have, this year, they went down quite a bit, which again was with the decline of our total dispatch calls. But for those other cities, as far as the officers, what they're handling on an hourly basis, daily basis, is significantly a lighter load. So looking at this, I think you can get an idea of that. It's the numbers of those officers, just to give you an idea, it's not on the slide, but Medford's 103 officers currently right now, Hillsboro approximately 133, and Sparks, Nevada approximately 108. That just gives you an idea of the type of caseload our officers that we're asking them to handle every day as we move forward with our plans for programs and such for use our calls.
Last biennium, we were able to purchase software to help us do what we call intelligence-led policing or data-driven policing. That helps us identify where the calls are. When you look at this map, it shows you pretty simply our calls in our data corridor. Part of the reason, I believe, is we've been able to push down these calls are, as we saw a significant reduction in the number of calls for service in the downtown area. That didn't come at a cheap cost. It cost about $64,000 last year to put officers on foot downtown the majority of the day. And we did see a significant reduction in crimes against people, specifically in that downtown area. So that's what brought some of the calls down. We were just down there on foot. What we've identified as true drivers of our calls right now are traffic collisions, mental health calls, and plain simple livability calls. Those things that really upset people that really don't rise to the level of felonies, but they really disturb our quality of life. This is an actual representation of the downtown area. As you can see above, that represents less than 1% of the downtown area, but it equates to almost 5% of our total calls, just in that small area. When I say the downtown area, I'm talking south of Greenwood, down to Idaho, from the river, across to Harriman. That's a concentration that brings us into that area. We still haven't got a handle on traffic collisions. They're going up. Now, we have plans in place for this. I authorized last October for an additional traffic position. It takes us a year. You've heard this before. You've been here. It takes us a year to get an officer on. By the time we complete a hiring process, send them to a 17-week academy, do a 17-week ride along with our officers to make sure that they fit the city of Bend, make sure they fit our culture, and they deliver the service we want. It takes us almost a year to get an officer on. We've moved a sergeant over onto that team already, and we're going to move the other officer onto it in the fall. We're hoping to have not only daytime traffic coverage, but evening coverage to help deal with the impaired drivers. We're still in this area, we're also using data-driven policing. We send our officers to where the crashes are. I don't have that map with me. Anybody wants to contact me, I'll send that to you. This shows you the hotspot. I can tell you right off the top, the Reed Market Corridor, Greenwood and 3rd, are still very, very active crash locations. And they're spread out throughout the city. And that's how we deploy our traffic team. We also deploy them in sporadic to the parkway where we have the speeding issue. Our speeds went significantly down from what they were 3 years ago, the overall speeds on there, which is encouraging.
Do I remember that there were certain collisions you decided not to send an officer to? Is that still the case?
We've stepped back from that. We stepped back for that, and we're looking at readdressing that. We revisited that and thought that was a community service livability issue. Do we go to every one of them? No. A lot of times we get there, there's only one person there. But we found that it was really affecting our reputation within the community.
People wanted to see you.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true.
But that's as available. If we don't have officers available, we flat tell the folks out. It's not an injury accident. We tell them, well, if you're going to wait, you may be waiting 45 minutes.
I'm curious in this data if there is any connection to seasonality and any connection to alcohol.
I can't tell you factually. I had a slide that showed the months when the accidents occurred. I took it out because I want to cut down a little bit.
I'm just curious. We have this huge influx of tourists in the summertime. We have a huge marketing campaign on the Bend Ale Trail, and we've got a big increase in our motor vehicle collisions. And it could absolutely not be connected, or there could be some correlation.
There'll always be a correlation to that. But how strong the correlation is, I'm not sure. I know during one weekend period, our officers arrested 13 drunk drivers in a two-day period. When we had a low call volume of responding to calls, they were able to go proactive, and we arrested 13 drunk drivers in a two-day period. So we're hoping to be able to address the impaired driver. We have grave concerns about the marijuana law coming in, because very quickly we have no way to test for marijuana other than an observation test. We have no chemical test other than ask for urine. And it's going to be challenging for us. But then again, last year you gave me another body, and we'll get that person on there. And hopefully we can start working on impaired driving and up the amount of specialized officers we have to assess people under the influence of anything other than alcohol.
Chief, question about, I'm looking at the performance measures.
Yes.
And you explained, I think, a slide or two back why the actuals in 2014-15 were way down. And so I'm trying to figure out why in 2015 and 16 and then the next fiscal year there's a projected increase back to levels that exceed what they were before, in fact, before this current year. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Which performance measure are you taking to directly?
Okay, so I'm referring to the calls for service per patrol officer.
We're expecting a climb, projecting a climb in population. We're also expecting a climb in the amount of tourists, quite frankly. Well, I've spoken with ODOT. We're seeing traffic counts up. Not significantly, but we're seeing traffic counts up. So we're expecting that to climb back up. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And so, obviously, also, you're projecting the increase in calls per officer to exceed the population growth, though. Is that right?
The other factor that we factored into that is when it's just 1 year, we look at an average of the previous 4 or 5 years, because we're still a small enough city where if we're down 1 year, we can't say absolutely yet that these programs have decreased these calls. We still look for a trend over a 4 or 5 year period.
Okay.
With that trend, we still see that increase in calls over the next 2 years. Next year, if we see that number lower again, then we'd probably revisit that and look and say, okay, maybe we don't take that average, maybe we change that formula we use. But we did average out over the previous 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
Mental health calls. We've almost doubled in 3 years. We have already put training in place for all our officers. By February this year, we have all of our officers trained in advanced, it's an advanced tactical ability to talk to people who are in mental health crisis. It's called crisis intervention training. We have 100% of our officers there in February. We still are seeing the rise. We have other plans in place. I was authorized to hire 2 officers and a sergeant to address these mental health calls. They'll be working in partnership with Deschutes County Mental Health in the cars with us in a proactive manner, going out and contacting these people, whether they live in a tent or where they live in a house or where they live. We're hoping that will drive down the frequency and the length of time. These are extremely staffing hour. Every mental health call takes 2 to 4 officers because of the volatility of the unknowns of it. So when you look at tying 2 to 4 officers up for 30 minutes or tying them up for 45 minutes, or the wait periods at the hospital that have gone, we've had wait periods up to 5 hours at the hospital. They just don't have the capability of dealing with it, and that's something long-term we need to look at. How do we better do this? And we're working with Deschutes County Mental Health, we're working with St. Charles, and trying to figure out a way to do this. But for right now, we're in October, we'll be deploying a unit to help address this. Specific officers with advanced training to go out with mental health to contact these people and help push these numbers time frames down. Community response team, we're trying to figure out ways to think outside the box what traditional law enforcement does, not just responding, not just arresting, but to actually reach out and do this. And we're copying, we're not geniuses. We're looking around the nation, finding who's doing the best job at all of it, and we're kind of stealing pieces of that. San Antonio's a model we're using for what we call the social service unit, going out and contacting folks in mental health crisis before. They have an excellent. So to do that, we set up an entire separate team with a lieutenant and two sergeants to deal with these issues. As you can see, we broke it up with intelligence-led policing. We're going to be dealing with the hotspots, like that. The map we showed earlier. That sergeant also is going to be liaisoning with the neighborhood associations and the downtown associations on a one-on-one basis to see what they need and what they perceive as the threats are and how we can address those. We're also going to have an education component where we're going out. We're doing that already with this unit. We're going out to the senior centers providing training on how to best protect themselves from fraud, how to protect themselves from internet fraud, how to protect themselves from somebody calling up and saying, my grandson's in prison in Mexico, you need to send $700 immediately. We're going out proactively, going to the community. The traffic team, again, is a part of this. We see this community response team is addressing the key issues of livability in them, as where our patrol team will continue to respond to calls on a daily basis. This team is going to specifically go to the livability issues. Questions? Our patrol team is also using intelligence-led policing. Every month they pick a problem in Bend, they design a plan to deal with the problem, they make projections on what they can see as measurable outcomes, and then they implement that plan. The idea is we get everybody in the mindset of being proactive and addressing the issues. We have limited officer staff. This way we can stretch our staff by addressing the problems that cause the most of our calls. Again, they provide your 24/7. They've set a goal to have 1,100 community-based contacts. That means officers getting out of their car, walking to parks, officers getting out of their car, walking through neighborhoods, officers getting out of their car, walking through sports events, and talking to people, be more visible, more community-oriented. They came up with this goal themselves, and it's going to work. You're going to see more cops out and about, deeper into the community than just driving their cars. Our solutions for livability, I've covered most of them. The social service team to help us drive down the mental health calls, the traffic team to help us drive down the crashes, the intelligence-led policing, which brings it all together. So we're focusing the limited staff we have on the issues we have. We're going to work closely with the code enforcement for special events. Make sure everybody understands what the rules of the special events are and help with compliance. And we're going to go out, we're going to reach out with this community team also to all the promoters, all the bar owners, and make sure they understand prior to the event clearly what the ordinances are dealing with noise and those issues which affect the communities around them, and try to be proactive and engage with partners. If that doesn't work, then we'll move on to enforcement. A couple of firemen snuck in the middle of our honor drive. I don't know how that happened.
The guys in skirts.
Yeah. I have a question. Of all of your statistics, your calls that you have, how many are repeat offenders? How many people, how many people do you see over and over and over again?
Anecdotally, what the FBI told us over the years, keeps all of our stats. We deal with about 10% of the population 90% of the time. I recently pulled some statistics in the downtown area, and we found that 8 offenders who we continuously deal with, we've dealt with 56 times in the past year.
Okay, I ask that because, and I understand, the population grows, the number of calls are going to grow. Anecdotally, people would say, well, if you see those numbers of calls go down, that means we're doing good to fight crime. But I asked that question specifically, and you talked about, I assume some of those are mental health issues because that's where a lot of it comes from.
Yes.
Social modeling. How much, devoting more time to dealing with those folks up front before crime happens, with the mental health providers, how much can you do on that end to prevent dealing with those 90% of the people 10% of the time?
That's where we're focused. That's what the focus of this is using intelligent policing to identify the cluster cause, identify the cluster of individuals causing the cause, and directly and proactively deal with them so we don't have to deal with them on the other end. It's, I can't give you an exact statistic. You know, we're talking mental health calls. We're talking 11-12% of our overall calls. That's a substantial challenge.
Yeah, that's a large one.
And then when it expands the time frame, I'm telling you, sending four officers on these calls, spending 45 minutes on it, it really eats your staffing hours up off the road. So the idea is we use intelligent policing to take us to the people. 2 years ago, we hired a crime analyst. She does a phenomenal job identifying individuals who are resource heavy for us. And that's what this intelligent policing is also going to deal with, directly with those folks. And addressing what you're talking about, driving down the calls with those individuals, freeing up officers' time so they can be more out in the community, be more proactive.
Yeah, and that's just for what it's worth. That's what I would be in favor of in terms of your spending going forward. Focus on that aspect.
That's our entire focus.
Okay.
Even if it's just anecdotal, what effect are you seeing with your officers handling so many calls relative to your staffing level? Because you were significantly higher in terms of, you know, the number of loads, cases each officer is taking. Are you seeing a burnout rate of anything? Have your guys been available for a while?
We saw that. We saw that last year. I've got some really, really smart young officers. We started looking at wellness overall for police officers. Mm-hmm. And we've put in some really good programs in place about wellness. We have, yoga. We brought yoga into the department with mindfulness and meditation to help officers release some of that stress. It can be a tough job. You know, an officer goes from a suicide helping somebody really nice to the next, they've got to have the ability to dissipate that. What we see is, what really gets us, we run so close within, is when we come to the flu season, mm-hmm. and people start getting sick, and you have one person off on vacation, it can stretch us. The overall health of the officers is very well at this point, because we're backfilling with yoga, we're backfilling with the kind of programs they need to help them stay resilient.
I don't know who the best person is to answer these questions because they're number related, but whoever speaks first will get to answer it. And so I have a couple of questions about the training program. And I noticed that both personnel services and material and services both increased 50%, approximately 50%. And that obviously was because of the addition of one FTE, at least I assume that. And one FTE does represent 50% increase. This is a pretty expensive program, I've noticed, among the four different programs that are described. And so, first I was gonna ask you what the justification for the need for an additional FTE is.
Sure. We'll start there?
Yeah.
We were finding that we were not meeting our training targets required by the state for hours. And the problem is it takes a coordinator to coordinate those. We had one sergeant working in there, and he was not able to keep up with all the mandatory training, whether it be state BOLI mandated training, federally mandated training, or police academy training. We were finding that just we were not able to keep with that up. That's half of why the additional FTE is in. The other half is we really are instilling a culture so we don't end up like Baltimore, we don't end up some of these places in a real mess. Mm-hmm. We're doing proactive training for our officers, how to use something other than your pistol. That takes training, and that takes, it's not training where you sit and look at a board, it's repetitive muscle learned training. So when you get in that stress spot, you're not reaching for your gun, you're reaching for your capstone, or you're reaching for your taser. We saw that as a real threat in today's environment where so many incidences of weapons being used, firearms being used. So we came back and we said, we know that we cannot support a change in culture or an emphasis on using less lethal weapons unless we up the number. The idea was we pay it ahead a little bit so we aren't paying the lawsuit later down the line. That was our focus on bringing it in there, twofold, to make sure we hit the state and federal requirements for training and also keep Bend out of the paper off CNN.
Yeah, well, and that's very good because there's a lot of public attention right now on police forces. How long does each training, trainings are discrete amount of time, I take it. It's not an ongoing kind of thing. Is that right or not?
That's not correct.
That's not correct.
We entered an agreement with our police association, our police union, if you will, where they give back one day every quarter. And so we have a six-hour training day every quarter of the year, which we help with that mandatory training and help with the other training, which really cuts down our training costs. It's cut them down by half in our overtime. Otherwise, you'd have to bring these officers in on overtime to train them, because we run so efficiently and with such a low number of officers, as you saw, compared to other agencies, that we couldn't take them off patrol, or you wouldn't have a cop answering your calls. So we were able to quarterly have the mandatory training, get that in place, and specialized training throughout the year.
Okay. The accreditation certification, that's part of what this program is tasked with, right?
That's correct.
And how much of a, can you cite a cost for what that is to the department? The amount of time? I'm after actually trying to pin down exactly what the needs of the training program are and what the costs are related to that. And accreditation is the certification process is one of those, correct? Is that part of the training program, or is that?
It resides within that division.
But it's a separate kind of thing.
Yes, it's an administrative function, the accreditation part is. And what it does also, it lessens our insurance costs if we're accredited. There is a payback on the back end, the exact figure I can't give you. But it does, I know it does lessen our insurance costs.
Okay. And do you have any sense of how much cost is involved in that accreditation certification?
I don't, sir.
Okay. So I'm getting the sense that the training is actually, it's not a discrete kind of thing. It varies with the type and focus of the training. And so that's going to answer the question that I had about the 12 new officers that were trained and the cost for that on a per training basis of per officer looked like it was going to be $71,000, which is a horrendously large number. But obviously what is going on here is that there's ongoing training for existing officers as well. Correct? Okay.
Correct.
Okay. That's all on the training program. There's a few other questions, too, I hope. No one minds. So the other, another program is the criminal investigation program, and maybe Paul can help with this. So I noticed that that this program has projected a reduction in FTEs, correct? From 21 to 19 to fewer employees. That's correct? That's what the budget is
stating.
Yeah,
the budget notes that. You might have shifted some folks
around. Yeah, I think that was, Juice Guy's number is in the narrative. Are you on the right page? So under criminal investigations, where we've calculated out the number of FTE funded out of each program, so they have their detectives work on rotation, so they'll spend a couple of years in investigations, rotate back out of patrol, and vice versa. So I think they have reallocated and redirected some of those staff into patrol.
Into something else.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So
it's just a matter of allocating that. That labor?
Yes.
Okay.
Because they actually have one new detective requested in the budget, a forensic detective.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and I did read that somewhere. And so maybe this is just an allocation of resources kind of issue, but I noticed that even with the reduction in FTEs, that there was actually a more than 2% increase in the personnel services, which caught my eye. And so I was wondering if there's, maybe Sharon can explain this.
Well, there's a couple of vehicles that need to be replaced. That's one of the reasons
Would that be in person?
So are you on?
You're looking at the, he's looking at the program
the total criminal investigation, so the 2773 to 2790?
Exactly.
Yeah. So that is, as Eric just mentioned, they have a couple of vehicle replacements.
Oh. Okay, so actually, the line that I'm focusing on is the personnel services, mm-hmm. the top line. And I noticed that between the combination of 2013-14 and 2014-15, that increases a little over 2% to what is projected for this next biennium.
I think I can answer that maybe.
Okay.
So some of this, with, and you kind of saw our calls for service and our calls per officer. In detectives, we try to balance what we take in as an investigation unit. But oftentimes when patrol numbers are down and our numbers are down, especially cyclical with injuries and stuff, a lot of that will come into overtime cost with that personnel, because we may have to take on more than we wanted to, more than even fits our guidelines of what we'll take. We're still a small enough department where our personnel costs, especially in a unit that size, would specifically the investigations part of that unit that really is focused around 8 to 10 people or 12 people when we count the drug unit as well, specifically doing those investigations. That can have quite a bit of fluctuation based off just an anomaly of a few big crimes in a year, and more so what impacts patrol. Sometimes we just have to go take certain calls for patrol that maybe wouldn't be the typical for us, but they're just out of bodies to do it. So once we're talking about the numbers you're looking at, I think it's a small enough difference to me where that could account for a lot of it.
It's a small number. What just caught my eye was that it's in the face of the fact that there's actually projected to be a reduction in force there. And so I expected there to be at least maybe a small reduction, but a reduction also in personnel services. But what you're saying is that there was some anticipation of increased overtime.
I thought you were talking about the actuals of 14-15, so I may have misunderstood.
Yeah, I think he's talking about the proposed.
Okay. Yeah, the proposed.
Intuitively, the personnel services, because you're increasing the FTB, you'd see a reduction in personnel services. I'm sure some of that is resulting in overtime because you're a little leaner there, and so you're having to
start the private coverage.
Yeah, so some of that could be, there might be other things going on. We can get back to you on that.
Okay, yeah. So there's a 9.5% decrease in FTEs, the two, if that's accurate number, and a 2.2% increase in personnel services. And so I thought, well, maybe there was a mistake somewhere in there, or perhaps there was something I just didn't understand. Over time could certainly explain some of that if you're projecting that.
Why don't
we look into it, and then we'll get back to
you. Okay. And so staying on that same budget breakdown for criminal investigation program, the materials and services, and I think there's probably a good answer to this, is increased 20% this next biennium compared to the current one.
That's not the industry vehicle.
It's not the capital part, capital outlay. It's just materials and services.
It goes up and then it goes down. So there's probably some one-time.
There's purchase. Some
equipment. Yeah, there is. That's right.
So let me look at the.
There's some computer equipment, some forensic.
Computer forensic.
Okay.
It's computer.
Okay. Good.
So we need to move. We need to move along to the next section of the presentation so that we can stay on schedule. And to facilitate that, I'm going to leave.
And really, really quickly before we jump into fire.
I have one question.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah. Well,
I will allow it just this one time, Mr. White.
I'm on the planning commission. One thing we hear is Galveston impacting on the neighborhood, both for noise and then behavior. We also heard some of the problems with short-term rentals were the same thing. Are you satisfied with our capacity to address those noise and behavior issues
at this point?
I was given an additional FTE to help with that this year. I'm not sure that I can project that until we see the impact. I think part of it is, like I explained earlier, we're going to start reaching out education-wise and engaging them in a more solid manner. We're consolidating that under the city manager's office permits, and we're working towards that. But we do have the additional FTE we were given.
So that's on your radar.
It's one of our council goals, actually, it's a project on our work plan to clarify the noise ordinance. Mm-hmm. We went through a lot of effort to create it, and we revised it. And there's some ways that I think we can streamline it. And so that's something that we're taking on as we've coordinated special events, noise, vacation rentals under one livability coordinator that's helping to do that. So it's definitely on the radar.
So really, really quickly before we move on to fire, there are two other funds that are kind of wrapped into the police program. One is the police grant fund, and that is a separate fund that we have to account for. They're called JAG grants, Justice Assistant Grants, and we have a separate fund that accounts for that grant activity, which is used to purchase one-time equipment and technology items. And then we have a police reserve fund that was created back in 2010 and set aside to provide some operating reserves for police in the event they have a significant unanticipated expense that they didn't anticipate and they don't have the budget to absorb it. So there's about we're planning to end the biennium with about $642,000 in that fund. And that fund, it's just reserves. We haven't budgeted to use that. And any use of that money would have to go to council. So that would require council action. So just wanted to point those out. Before we move on to fire, so that's your next yellow tab. The fire fund, most of their revenues is reflective of the contract that the city has with the Rural Fire Protection District, where both the city and the district contribute $1.185. Of our $2, and so for the city of our $2.80 permanent tax rate, $1.185 of that goes to fire, and the district matches that. And then also the local option, the property taxes generated from the local option levy. The charges for services revenue, that is ambulance and fire med revenue, there is an increase in the ambulance revenues in anticipation of an increase in the ambulance transport activity resulting from the new basic life support or BLS unit. You'll see the transient room tax revenues of about $137,000 in the first year of the biennium, $147,000 in the second year, and that is the portion of the room tax revenues that are dedicated to fire. And since police is funded out of the general fund, they have the exact same amount. It just doesn't show up in their budget summary. It's up in the overall general fund, but there is a separate line that we track those revenues specifically for police in the general fund. And then we are planning to issue $3 million of long-term debt that will actually go to council next Wednesday for the purchase and replacement of 6 fire engines. So that is the revenues in the fire fund. Expenditures, they have, they're projected to end the biennium with almost 130 FTE. They are requesting 17 new FTE, but 14 of those are the next BLS unit. So there's 14 FTE for the BLS program, and then three, and the BLS is 100% funded by the levy. And then there's 3 other firefighter positions requested. Bless you. Bless you. Their main materials and services expense, they have some one-time costs throughout the biennium for the onboarding and training of all the new BLS. And with all the new staff comes equipment and that type of thing. They also have some building and structures repair and maintenance. There's a slight increase there due to some deferred maintenance over the years. An increase in their drug costs, so they have a base inventory of drugs that they keep on the ambulances for servicing or assisting patients. So there's an increase in the drugs. And then we do have about $60,000 of bond sale expense, the debt issue cost associated with the debt. And then, as I mentioned, on the capital side, the big one is the replacement of the new fire engines. So with that, I'll turn it over to Larry, unless there's questions on the numbers.
Any questions? I'm Larry Langston, I'm the fire chief, and appreciate being here this evening. This is going to be exciting. We've been working on this a long time. This is Deputy Chief Bill Booz. He's been in this position 3 months, so we thought it would be a good time for him to do the presentation.
Trial by fire.
Bill has 19 years with the department, all of it in operations. Now he's moving into some of the administration, budget oversight, that kind of thing. So go ahead.
Yeah, I work pretty much hand-in-hand with Paul, so we're getting to know each other pretty well from TD. So, hope I do this right. Whoop, the wrong way. So, this is our new logo, and actually we went, and I wanted to show this to you. We took the Ben Bug, and we designed this into our new logo. So this is going to go on the new fire engines. And so it's pretty exciting that we're going to, and then we'll transition everything else over, but that takes money and time and that kind of stuff. So anyways, we're going to see those on the new fire engine, so we're pretty excited about that. One of the things, we're going, basically with this biennium budget, we're going into the second phase of what we told the voters with the levy. And there are really four things that we can have measures, we can be held accountable for. That's lowering our response times, making sure crews are available to respond to those calls, having a cost-effective response matrix, so something that is cost-efficient, and then also putting the right resource on the right calls. And that's really the key to this whole thing of what we're doing. Fire service is evolving right now, and it's moving really quickly, and so we just want to stay in front of that. One of the things that I wanted to show with this, and I guess the black lines didn't come through very well, but when we have a structure fire or wildland fire or whatever, if we don't get on scene quickly, it can really escalate into a very serious situation. So if we can get to a structure fire within, say, 5 minutes, it can be just a room and contents fire where we can attack it from the exterior, and it doesn't take that much time, and there's not a lot of property loss. As it takes us longer to get on those scenes, then we go from a room and contents fire to a structure fire, and then we're there for a long time, and there's a lot of manpower involved in that, and so that's why it's critical for us to get on scene quickly. The next one is cardiac arrest, and this is interesting because today, down at Park and Rec, the Forest Service was doing their PAC test, and a guy got done doing his PAC test and he had a heart attack. And the Forest Service was there, they had an AED, they shocked him within a minute, he was talking. So we got on scene right when they shocked him, he was talking, he didn't know what had happened. And so that's why it's critical to get on scene, as the doctor knows, get on scene as fast as we possibly can. There's high performance CPR now that's being used, but the quicker that we can get on scene, the better the outcome. The longer, if we get in 9 or 10 minutes, then it's really difficult for us, to have that opportunity for resuscitation. Right now, the national average is about 20% survivability. Ben, we're at 40%, which is awesome, for 13 and 14. And this year, we're at 50% resuscitation rate. So we're going up higher. And the two cities, Rochester, Minnesota, and Seattle, they're at 62%. And so we're hoping with this new EMS system that we're bringing in, we want to get to those levels. And so it's a pretty neat deal to be able to watch patients come out of the hospital that you didn't think would, that would happen. You can see from 2011 to 2014, our call volume has gone up. Fire calls have stayed pretty much the same. Fire calls are labor intensive. They take a lot of manpower, but our EMS calls are rising. And so we've gone from about 8,000 total calls. Now we're right at 9,000 calls, so you know, as the community grows and that kind of stuff, obviously our call volumes are going up. So in the second phase in this biennium budget, like Sharon was saying, in October we're going to add those three firefighter paramedics. They're going to staff our one-person quick response paramedic units that go with our VLS cars. And then in November, we'll hire those 14 folks to work in the VLS unit. That's a limited-term, part-time position. So it's kind of like an internship, but it's a really exciting program. We have our first group is just finishing their training. And it's really exciting to see them, and they're enthusiastic. They really enjoy what's going on, so we're looking forward to what will happen. So in about 2 weeks, we'll actually have them out running. And so we'll see the system actually.
Actually, about to middle next week.
About
the middle. They should be there, and they'll be going on calls. Might mention is...
I think it's neat to mention how diverse that group is. You know, age-wise, yes. Gender, it's a really
representative sample. We have from about 45 years old to 22, we have men and women. Terrific turnout for the recruitment of that. It was, and I should mention this to the Budget Committee because some of you are new. This is only possible because our fire association stepped up, and these are non-represented employees. So we're able to put one of these on the street for half the cost of a more traditional paramedic.
Yeah. It's pretty exciting stuff. So it's neat to see all of them in there. It's really exciting. Versus just young guys, you know, so it's nice to see the diversification of people. One of the things we talked about was our response time. So in 2013, our response time was around in the 90, took us about 9 minutes to get there. Currently, we're just under 8 minutes, and we're projected to be, we want to be about 6 minutes, 6.5 minutes. And so we feel like we're going to get there because, as you can see from 13 to currently where we are now, the difference there was we added another ambulance, a paramedic ambulance, and a squad, that two-person squad. So we're seeing where our response times are going down. Another, this is a big one here. This is basically the amount of time that we are out of resources in the city and in the district. So in 2013, almost 15 hours, there was no coverage whatsoever.
At this time of year,
yeah. And then 14, we dropped to 8 hours and 20 minutes because of that medic unit and the squad. And then 15, we're down to 5 hours and 32 minutes. So we're going to see that. If we're going from 8 units on the streets, by the time this is all done, we're going to have 13. So it's really exciting. Here's a picture of our quick response vehicles. This is going to be what our paramedics are going to be riding in. It's the first used in the state of Oregon, and I think it's this type of system that we're developing. I've never heard of it in the nation. And actually, last week we had the Oregon Fire Chiefs Conference, and there's a lot of fire chiefs asking us about the system that we're putting in place. And so they want to see everyone. There's a lot of eyes on Ben right now in the fire service to see how this all works out. And then we have our special response vehicle, which basically goes out and handles those non-emergent fire calls. So like illegal open burns, commercial alarms, those calls that you don't need to send an engine on, that one person unit can go and handle those. And that's about the eighth of the cost of an engine company. So it's really exciting. They actually will be, they're rolling out right now, and they'll be in place next week along with the VLS system. I wanted to show this, and this is really, and it was kind of like what Chief Porter was talking about, is where are our calls really occurring. The green dot up there, that's St. Charles. And so where the red is at is basically all the nursing home and care facilities, and that's where a large majority of our calls occur. And one of the things that we're looking at is possibly, is if we put a sixth station like at the Pilot View campus, what impact that would have. And I want to show this one. This This is basically all the gray shows where we can get to in 5 minutes. That black area, which is pretty much in the center of town, kind of 15th Street down in that area, it takes us a little bit longer. And the reason for that is where the South Fire Station is, over by the Country Club, they're surrounded by railroad tracks. And so for them to respond, they actually have to go through Roster House to make sure they avoid the tracks. If we had something where they could shoot down 15th Street, because that whole south end, we're going to see a lot of development, that's prime real estate down in there. And so that could make a big difference. And so that's one of the things that we're looking at. Capital improvement, Sharon talked about it. We'll be replacing the 6 engines. We'll be getting Rosenbauers. We actually have 2 guys back in Minnesota right now looking at them. Great. They're beautiful rigs. So we'll be getting those in August. And then in 17, we're looking at replacing the ambulances. The one thing with these ambulances, those are maintenance costs are going up dramatically, just because of the age of them and the use that we get out of them. And so we may come back a little bit earlier, we'll see, but the maintenance costs are going up on that. And then we're working with the district on replacing the Tumalo Fire Station, because that station is old and there's a lot of, it just needs to be, we need to rebuild that station. So we're in the works with working with the district on replacing the Tumalo Fire Station. And so that is it. You know, within our budget, we're sustainable during the life of the levy, so we're excited. We've got a lot of things going on. It's exciting times for us, so a lot of good stuff.
Congratulations on increasing or decreasing your response time while increasing your call volume. That's pretty good operation.
You know, and it's the men and women that are on the streets. I mean, they're dynamite. They're incredible people. We get top-notch folks that come here, and they're all really talented folks. And with the work with the association, like the chief said, and working with Eric and the city staff and you, the counselors and the voters, saying, you know, we believe in what you're doing. I mean, it's a great time. It's exciting. I like the city of Bend as a whole. I mean, the energy is phenomenal. It's great. It's a lot of fun working with everybody. So,
you say it costs about half to put these guys that are doing the basic life support out. Is that just in a sheer wage comparison between the two, and or training costs that are tied to, you know, what? That's a pretty big discrepancy.
It is. Because of the contract agreements we have with our career staff and the certifications required to even hire that staff and put them out there so they can respond across the city. It's about $800,000 to put an advanced life support unit in service. It can handle any call. We know about 60% of our calls could be done by a EMT level certification, non-firefighter, and we're bringing them in at a, we look at it as an internship, limited term, 3 years, and it gets their foot in the door, provides about, I think the salary for one that's working full time is about $22,000 a year, and some benefits. Mm-hmm. So we had for these positions, we had about 140 applicants.
Okay.
So we're able to do it for 400,000. And I think it's going to work great. They're very enthusiastic. They're going to work out of the firehouses. Our Firefighter Association is a great concept.
Great. Want to follow up on Casey's question. Did I hear you correctly say during your presentation that these employees were not represented?
Correct.
So, I mean, that's amazing to me.
There's a lot of you have heard this number before. There's about 25,000 fire departments in America. There's 4 that have tried this, the non-represented that we're aware of. Working within the fire department, not through a private company, but working within the employee group of the fire department, working out of the fire stations, but non-represented. Glendale, California is doing it, Huntington Beach. We're the fifth to try it, and we're the first to try the one-man unit rather than sending engine companies on everything. So, yeah, it's because of the trust between Firefighters Association and the management of the city, not just the fire department, the whole city.
And everybody seems to be happy. I'm just so impressed.
Memorandum of understanding. It took us 6 months to negotiate it, but it's done, and we've hired the people.
Can we do that citywide?
And then, was it 14 additional full-time employees?
14, yes.
14. And what does that get in terms of on any given shift? Is that like
two? That's one 24-hour ambulance, 7 days a week, because they're rotating shifts. Mm-hmm. Some are part-time. There's a few full-time. And we just hired 14 recently. Eric's been out and had lunch with them or met them a couple of times. The second group is in this budget, and we'll hire them in November or December. That'll be 14 more. That'll put the second one on the street. With the build-out idea of being one of those eventually have been located out of every firehouse.
And it's really designed for, you know, folks that are going to school, you know, that type of thing. It gets their foot in the door. And they don't, you know, there's no crossover with work. That had to be very clear. So it's an exciting program.
Yeah, and just so there's not a misunderstanding, they'll go out in this, in an ambulance, two EMTs, these new employees. But going in tandem with them will be that one-man unit. And rather than an engine, the one-man unit will go. And it'll be a paramedic firefighter. They'll take a look at that patient, do a field assessment, determine if they can go in safely to the hospital with the EMTs, or if not, he'll jump on the unit and go in with them and come back later to pick up them.
What level of EMTs are there? Are they?
They're just nationally certified EMT ones.
Ones,
yeah,
okay.
One basic now.
Yeah.
So, just to stay on track, and
okay.
David, I don't just to, unless there's anything else,
no.
You're kind of taking over from Peter. Okay. And we're on. Thank
well,
you.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for all your time you're putting into this. So, yeah, thanks.
Okay, really quickly, fire also has one other fund that's part of the fire program, and that's the fire station debt service fund. So it's towards the back of that yellow fire tab, right before the line item detail starts. And that fund is used to account for debt service. The city built several of the fire stations in partnership with the rural district, so we have an agreement with them. And the stations are owned by the district, but the city issued the debt. So the city is responsible for the annual debt service of those full faith and credit bonds that were issued, and then collect money from the district to make those debt payments. So that's the debt service fund. A couple of other funds to round out public safety. Municipal court, so your next yellow tab. The municipal court program is also accounted for as a division of the general fund. So it's 100% funded by general fund discretionary revenues. They have four FTE supervisor and three court clerks. There's no new increase in staff requested, and their budget is kind of pretty status quo. So I can answer any questions. See none. Then the rent, so the Helen Lorenz Estate Fund, your last yellow tab. For the new members of the Budget Committee, and I'm not sure if Council is aware of Helen Lorenz. She was a resident of Bend that passed away a couple of years ago and left her estate, which was valued at about $1 million, to police and fire. So she had some restrictions on what that money could be used for. She was pretty particular. She didn't want it to just be used for new employees or replacement of routine vehicles that really would be part of the city's ongoing operating expenses. So wanted that, wanted her estate funds to be used for special training, employee recognition, award programs.
Opportunities to innovate and try new things.
And then had some historical, you know, like the fire department bought an old historical fire, one of their old historical fire engines with it. So this fund is just used to, police and fire have, they work with, through the Oregon Community Foundation, the OCF is where this money is held. And they have a board of trustees that police and fire have to go to submit proposals and get approval from those folks to use their money. So the funds just come into this separate special revenue fund and then get transferred to police and fire. Any questions on that?
So the return is just basically set by OCF?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they have approved purchases that they approve. And it's local community members that serve on that board. Like Andy Jordan, the former police chief, is one of the people on the that's approving the purchases for police, and I think fire has some retired individuals on their board as well. So, okay. So with that, our last section of the night, community and economic development. So now we're into purple. And I'm going to talk about the financial discussion for building, planning, and code enforcement all together, and then I'll turn it over to Mel because his presentation is kind of for all of community development, building, planning, and code enforcement all kind of integrated. So I'll just go ahead and talk about the financial picture for all three of those. So the building fund, you can see we have an increase in license and permit fee revenues. As I mentioned last night in the overall revenue forecast, we're not requesting any CPI increase in fees because they do have money programmed in their budget this biennium to do a fee increase. So they aren't asking for any across-the-board increase in fees in advance of that fee study. We are projecting a 5.3% increase in building activity the first year of the biennium, and 11.5% in the second year. Another thing to point out, you'll see the big increase in interfund transfer revenues. If you look down below in their requirements by program, there's a new program for the Permit Center. So prior to this upcoming biennium, building, planning, and private development engineering all were paying a portion through their personnel services, a portion of 13 permit center staff, primarily permit technicians. And so to kind of make the cost of that permit center program a little more transparent, we created a separate group of account numbers so we can really track those costs separately in the building fund. So we're tracking the building and electrical inspection program separate from the permit center. And the cost for that permit center are funded, building is paying for half of it, and then the other half is split equally 25% and 25% from current planning and private development engineering. So those two programs are transferring money into the building fund to pay their share. The largest increase in materials and services, if you look down towards the bottom of the page, the expenditures by type, you'll see the materials and services increases. In an effort to digitize all of their plans, they have budgeted $500,000 per year to start scanning is way oversimplifying, digitizing all those plans so they can eliminate the mounds and mounds and mounds of paper and make it more efficient for them, but as well as for the public that wants information on some of that electronic plan information. On the personnel side, Building is planning to end the biennium with almost 40 FTE, which reflects a request of 4 new staff. They have 2 new building inspectors and 2 new plans examiners that are requested, and then some vehicle purchases in the biennium, most of which are replacements. They do have, since they're bringing on new staff, they do have 3 new vehicles. And they are scheduled to end the biennium with $8.7 million in contingency, which is about 15 months of their operating costs. So as I mentioned earlier when I was talking about the policy reserve levels for development funds, our target is kind of 6 to 18 months, and so building is right in there at 15 months. So any questions on the building numbers before I flip over to planning?
One of the things I noticed in fire, and I noticed again here, is in terms of building the contingency, it looks at, for instance, in 1516 it's 7.5 and then it's 1.1.
Mm-hmm.
In 1617 it was similar to that, I think, in the fire. Is there, what's the strategy?
Oh yeah, so if you look up at the top of the page on building, you'll see the beginning working capital. So the beginning working capital in 1516 is $6.8 million. Do you see that? So that's the anticipated reserves that we're expecting to end 1415 with that will carry forward and roll into the new biennium. But we only have, on a budget basis, we only budget for beginning working capital in the first year of the biennium, because it's the reserves available at the beginning of the biennium, so on July 1, 2015. So if you wanted to do the math to see the increase in contingency and reserves for that year, it would be the 7.5 minus the 6.8. Mm-hmm. So the ending minus the beginning. Since we haven't budgeted for any beginning working capital in 16-17, the 1.1 million contingency, that represents the annual revenues, how much the annual revenues exceed their operating expenses. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay. So flipping over to planning, the next purple tab. The planning fund accounts for current planning and the SIGN program. Prior to this fiscal year, so through fiscal year 13-14, the long-range planning functions were accounted for in the planning fund, but they were transferred out when we created the growth management department, which was the Nick Arnes's fund that we talked about last night. So the planning program is primarily funded by the charges for services, or the planning and sign permits and fees. They do have about $500,000 of general fund subsidy each year of the biennium, and that covers 100% of the city-initiated development code updates, 100% of the planning staff time that's dedicated to the pre-application meetings, half of the SIGN program costs, and half of the kind of general services, general front counter services. And all of those kind of funding mechanisms were approved by council last July, I believe. The 100% of the city-initiated code updates, the pre-application meetings, the SIGN code, and the general services is all set in bend code. And they are projected to end the biennium with 11 FTE, and there's no new planning staff requested. And their ending reserves at the end of the biennium are about $2.7 million, which is about 13 months of their operating reserves. Oh, and on the revenues, they have we mentioned this yesterday, but a 2% CPI increase each year of the biennium, and then a projected 8% increase in activity projected for the first year of the biennium, and 5% the second year. And then code enforcement. So if you skip over the growth management that we talked about last night, the code enforcement tab. Code enforcement is a community development program that's accounted for, it's 100% accounted for in the general fund. They have four FTE, which includes the new code enforcement technician that council authorized in October of 2014 to focus on some of the livability issues. So there is an increase in their personnel costs because they've had some staff vacancies in 14-15, but there's no new additional staff requested in the budget. And they do have one new vehicle. That's it on code enforcement. Okay, so I'll turn it over to Mel for the presentation.
Thanks,
Mel. Were you prepared to talk? Do you want to talk through any of your numbers?
I don't have to say anything. Right? I'll just quickly run through a few slides to kind of show you what CD Community Development does and what our staffing and workload kind of looks like. Nice try. Okay, so community development, we really touch a lot of the businesses and agencies and citizens in the community. Because what we're doing is we are developing the land in Bend, where anyone who wants to develop in Bend has to come through community development. So first and foremost, we are implementing City Council goals and their growth management policies, as well as their standards that are found in the Development Code. And probably most importantly, we are implementing public involvement. Almost every land use decision or action that we take involves some form of public involvement, notification of property owners, and ability of property owners to get engaged in the development of their community through the land use process. We consider ourselves an engine of economic development. I did a presentation, and over the last 10 years, we've added $2.7 billion of assessed value to the city. That translated into about $8 million to the general fund in revenue from taxation. We work with private development. They are our major customers. They come to the front, they take the risk to build the community. And our objective is to help them minimize that risk and get through the process by meeting all the codes and standards of the city in the most timely and efficient manner that we can. We interface with the fire department. The building safety code is a minimum code. It is the first line of defense for fire. We ensure that fire safety are built into every building, not only for the occupants of the building, we're concerned that all the occupants who are in the building can get out of the building safely by the way we design the building. And we also provide design for how fire operators can access the building and fight the fire from the outside. We also interface with parks and schools in our planning efforts to ensure that if there are any park requirements or any safe school issues that need to be addressed for development, they are taken care of. Along with transportation engineering, which is a big issue for most development. They always bring trips to the system, and those trips may trigger improvements to intersections, and that becomes usually a major issue in most of the developments that we review. So, having said that, these are the department programs, the Permit Center, which Sharon discussed, is comprised mostly of permit technicians who serve as the front counter, do over-the-counter permitting, and support the building planning and private development engineering staff in processing applications. We do addressing. We create all the addresses in the city, which are then related to 911, taxation assessment, as well as just commercial delivery services. You want to find some place in Bend, you got to have an address. So we create those. Sign code administration. We have a sign code that was adopted in 2000. It's been updated a couple times since then. Regulates the placement of signs for all businesses in the city of Bend. Code enforcement currently now enforces the sign code as well as the planning code, the building safety code, the Bend municipal code, and we're going to also take on the right-of-way enforcement of people who work in right-of-way permits. We will be able to do code enforcement on those folks. And then we took over from the fire department the wildfire fuel abatement program. They did it for years. We took it over about 4 years ago. And it's really to regulate fuels that exist in Bend, from unmowed lawns or vegetation that's just allowed to run wild and pose a potential fire hazard in Bend. And finally, we also enforced the invasive species regulations, which really find their home in Deschutes County, but the city of Bend takes on that role within our city. Then we do planning, and planning is about entitlement of land, zoning regulations, design standards, and other uses such as vacational rentals, accessory dwelling units, and other hot buttons that you're faced with. And then building safety, which is the minimum safety code, which ensures all buildings are constructed to a safe standard. And we focus a lot on accessibility and building safety as it relates to the private side of the equation. There's a public side where we look at, you know, streets, where that's what private development engineering does. We look at streets and accessibility there. But when you get inside, when you get into the private property, then there are a whole bunch of regulations that apply to accessibility there. Parking regulations for accessible parking, path of travel to doorways, door pressures at doors, accessible counters, accessible bathrooms, all that has to be complied with, and that's what we do. So some of the key performances I'll show you are just some relationships between department staff, control permits, code enforcement, planning, and building. I threw this one in at the last minute. It doesn't meet the color code. I think it gives you a broader perspective on what's happened in Bend for the last 10 years and kind of where we're going right now and how the bars represent staffing and how we have struggled in the early part of the last decade to maintain some parity with development. We were understaffed early on in that decade, and then we were overstaffed in the middle of the first few years of it, simply because we were slow to respond to the rate of growth and the rate of decline of development. Since then, I think we've calibrated our ability to stay more in parallel with the rate of growth. I mean, our challenge is to sustain economic growth by maintaining parity with the rate of development. If we fall behind that, then we actually are an impediment to economic growth. So our challenge is to really try to maintain staffing levels as close as we can to that red line. So this kind of shows you that we're achieving that. Here's on the building side, where the bar equals the workload, the applications, and the line equals the staff that were actually doing the plan reviews and the inspections for the development. The same for planning. We had a little blip there in 2015, and anybody want to guess what that blip was? It was 400 vacation home rentals, okay? So as the council was contemplating regulating vacation home rentals at a different level, we had a flurry of applications. So we figured, well, we'll take that off, and we really have a pretty steady growth in application rate when we take off that 400. And we've been able to maintain pretty much a good ratio of applications per planner, which is, for our goal, is about 100 applications. And then finally, for code enforcement, pretty much a steady growth in code enforcement casework. We've enlarged the program over the years, and we're continuing to take on more. And we'll obviously see some extra activity related to vacational rentals in the coming years, as well as more activity related to code enforcement and for working in place directly. So really, that's all I have. Any questions?
Back on the graph where you were, look at the red line, because there's a little bit of a gap. Does this next budget address trying to close that?
It does. I'm sorry. This graph should have probably gone on to project that to 15-17.
Okay.
And particularly on the building side, it does close the gap.
And what are the assumptions based that got you to your projected permit numbers?
We're using 12% year over year by the end of it.
Okay.
And we're seeing that come true.
Mm-hmm.
We had projected more of a downturn in 2015. It wasn't really a downturn, it was just like a flattening or a reduction in the rate of growth. but it really only manifests itself about 3 months of 2015. And since then, it's been back on a growth rate of about 4%. So we're taking in anywhere from 30 to 40 single family home permits a week, which translates into quite a bit per month. And we're projecting probably for the year we'll end on single family detached home permits issued of about 900 to 1,000, which is really healthy. It's on the strong side of healthy. I was at a meeting with a building contractor developer Tuesday, and he said that their threshold is when they see Ben get to about 1,200 homes per year, they're out of the market because they don't think that's sustainable, and we're just pushing them on. So who knows? We'll find out. Mm-hmm. But our objective is to maintain some parity, but as we get closer to that above 1,000, and we're also projecting what we think of the mild recession in 2018, 2019, as we get closer to that, we want to hold back on hiring, maybe hire temporary, part-time, or limited term, so that we can maintain our core staff and lighten the load as we get into trouble.
Mel, so this graph shows the relationship between staff numbers and permits.
Yes.
Is there a correlation between staff, or should there be a correlation between staff and size of the projects that are permitted?
That's a terrific question. I think we'll be able to get there at some point. We haven't had the analytical skills or capability to do that, but we do now. We hired a really talented person as a performance analyst, and all of a sudden, we're able to really dig deep and mine the data that we're sitting on. And I think we would like to make some more proportional relationships, because you're right. I mean, a commercial building, the size of one of these dorms up here, it's a two-year project. It can take 500 inspections, and then a little single-family addition could take two inspections.
Right.
So it's kind of good to get perspective on it. So.
I thought you were going to hire another person because of the short-term rentals, the necessity for inspections of short-term rentals. Has that already been done?
Council already approved that.
That's right. Okay. And so that was one of the two FTEs that happened.
In code enforcement. So we have four code enforcement officers in code enforcement now. Okay. So we think we're positioned for whatever happens in the kitchen.
Thanks.
So last fund of the night. So before Russ jumps into his presentation, we're going to flip back to the blue engineering tab. So as I mentioned last night when we were talking about the engineering and infrastructure planning department budgets, the CIP budget, the engineering fund is used to account for both the CIP engineering work as well as private development engineering. Private development engineering, their budget is really consistent with the discussions we had with council at the April financial retreat. They recently completed a fee study to reassess their fees to bring them in line with being 100% fee supported and building adequate reserves. So they have that, the goal is to get to 12 months reserves over a three-year period. And this budget reflects that, so it reflects the fee increases necessary to get them to, they're at 8 months reserves, at the end of the biennium, which is $1.2 million. And they do have about $70,000 per year in general fund subsidy for their involvement in the pre-application meetings. So that's consistent with the BIN code and the subsidy support that the general fund is getting planning for those same activities. The majority of their expenses are personnel. They're projected to end the biennium with about 9 FTE, and that includes 3 new staff, 1 engineering associate, 1 engineer, and 1 inspector. And they also have 3 new vehicles over the biennium. And you can see their detail if you flip to the third page of the narrative. At the top of the page, that's their budget their expenditure budget by category. So you can see private development has the same, the transfers, you see that big increase in interfund transfers. And that, as I mentioned a minute ago, is to pay for their portion of the permit center staff. So they pay 25% of the cost of the permit center. And that's why you don't see, even though they're adding three new people, their personnel services don't increase that much from 14-15 to 15-16, because they do have the reduction in direct salary and benefit costs for those permit techs that they were paying for directly out of their fund. So that's the private development engineering budget. Any questions before Russ does this presentation? All right.
Good evening. I'm Russ Grayson. I'm the city engineer, and I manage the private development engineering department, which is a separate department. We are a separate department. I report directly to John, but we are housed in CDD. We use CDD resources in terms of permit tech and administrative support, but my budget is in EIPD, so if you follow that now. I'm going to go real quick because I was in front of you back in April about more in depth of what our department does, but I'll just do a quick recap. We work hand in hand with the community development department on basically 70% of the land use applications that come in. We have four main areas that our work is involved in. The first is working with land use applications as they come in and development proposals to determine what they need to build in the public right-of-way. Basically, a great way to think about our department is that if there is any public infrastructure that is going to be constructed that doesn't utilize city funds or some other direct governmental source of funding coming in, it goes through our department. So all the infrastructure related to schools, parks, and private development, subdivisions, commercial development, that's what we do, and we have to make sure that we integrate those infrastructure requirements into all the plans that the master plans that the engineering folks do, coordinate with the utility division on their projects and how they like to run certain infrastructure projects that we're going to do. Because all we basically do is we are the handoff. We have a very short life cycle with the project, usually 2 to 3 years. If someone wants to do something, we get it built, and then we turn it over to someone who's going to maintain it in perpetuity. We also permit everything in the right-of-way. So we work on the land use applications, and then we do all the permitting for all the infrastructure. So infrastructure related to land use applications, we work on all the right-of-way permits. So if someone wants to do a driveway or repair their sidewalk in the public right-of-way, they have to get a permit through us. Franchise utilities, Cascade Gas, Bend Broadband, Pacific Power, whenever they cut the road or want to lay a new line, they're under their franchise agreements, they're supposed to come and get a permit so we can make sure that they are located in the correct area of the public of the right-of-way. And then our last branch is we kind of provide general services just like the rest of CDD. So front counter services, we're answering questions on what do I need to do if I want to build this project to my septic tank is failing, how do I fix it? Or I need to tap a new water service, how do I do that? Provide those services. I'm also responsible for overseeing the city standards and specs for public improvements. So that's our standards in terms of how we want the public infrastructure constructed. And then we also provide a lot of large project coordination. So I'm hand in hand in most of the meetings with school districts, parks, schools, large scale projects that happen in the city, to make sure that we are helping facilitate them through the entire process and helping them avoid the landmines that they'll typically run into as they go through the process. It's kind of a high-level overview of what we do. So just real quick, we are a really new department. I arrived in Bend in late 2011 as the private development engineer under the community development department in 2013, as the economy started to come back. This department was created just due to the workload of not only what was going on in CDD, but also with the with Tom's group and EIPD, just their scale projects. it was determined to break the city engineer out into a whole separate department. And so when it was created, I moved over to that, and I was a department one. So as you see here, in 2013, it was just me. On the left side is the value of the public improvements that we've accepted through private development projects. This doesn't look at right-of-way permits or anything else. This is just what we're accepting through subdivisions and private development projects. And then the accelerator went down on the economy, and we quickly went. So in 2014, I effectively doubled the size of my department with the hire of another engineer. In late 2014, really the beginning of 2015, we hired an engineering tech who has her engineering degree, who is a permit tech, and we said, well, we can definitely use her on the engineering side. And the pedal just hasn't slowed down. So we are asking for an additional two engineers over the next biennium. And what we've been able to do, we recently did a fee study, which I know is a topic of discussion here, to get ourselves in alignment. So when you charted what our revenues were versus what our workload was versus our staffing needs, they were all out of line. We were not receiving the revenue needed for the staff that we needed. And with this fee study and with the proposed fee increases, we are trying to get those lines to all come back together. And it took us a couple years to really figure out what does our program need to do, what's our role within the city, how do we interact with all the various departments. Once we were able to secure that, then we were able to figure out, well, what staffing do we need, and how do we want to try to fund that. We also have two inspectors, full-time inspectors right now. We're asking for a third inspector, so our inspectors go out and they provide inspection services on every driveway and sidewalk that's built with every single family house. So most of the single family houses that occur, probably 80% of them, they're building driveways and sidewalks. Our crews go out there, make sure they meet all the current standards. On top of that, we're managing about anywhere between 35 to 50 public infrastructure projects going on around the city at any time. And we have to manage traffic control, road closures. We've kind of become the hub of trying to be the referee, wearing the black and white striped shirt, to figure out who goes where. And as you drive around the east part of town, it's going to be very apparent the issues that we're having, trying to figure out how to keep traffic flowing but still allow these development projects to go on. So our inspectors are out there. What you'll notice is we're adding a third inspector, but our workload is going through the roof. And the reason you see that is we are changing the program for inspection services in the city, where it is just not feasible for us to try to fund and manage the inspection services that we need based off of the ramp of development. And also the cyclical nature of development, not only over years, but also within the calendar year. Assuming that we may have a winner again sometime that we didn't have this year, that, you know, in reality, if we needed to put the inspectors out there to really ensure that we're getting the quality products turned into us in the city, we probably should be running anywhere at any time between 5 to 7 to 8 inspectors. And we realize it's just not really feasible based off of our structure, and also, what do we do with them in the winter, too? So we are actually changing the structure to work to require the private development side, the developers and the engineers, to provide inspection services as part of their projects to offset the need, so we can have our inspectors available for coordination and working with the franchise utilities and traffic control and other things. It's done in a majority of the other cities in the country. Where I came from, this happened all the time, where our inspectors are still there, but they're not the ones that are standing out on the job every day inspecting, because what we want to make sure is that it's certified by the engineer of record when it's done, when it comes in, and that our inspectors are there during critical portions of that project to make sure that it's built to our standards and specs. So that program we're getting ready to launch now, because our biggest concern that we have on the inspection side is that our crews just cannot get to everywhere they need to be. We typically have anywhere between 18 to 25 daily call inspections for right-of-ways, which is driveways, sidewalks, franchise utilities. That basically takes one inspector out just trying to do that, and then we have 40 infrastructure jobs going on. So we have inspectors running around checking driveways while we're putting in $1 million worth of pipe. So we're trying to completely restructure that program, because our biggest concern is that we don't have eyes on the big infrastructure going on, and all that's going to do is turn around and cause major maintenance problems, which we saw during the last boom. We have evidence around town where trenches are sinking, and we had problems with lift stations, which just turns into maintenance dollars on the back end. So if we can catch it up front with enough engineers to review the plans, to make sure they meet our current standards, have enough people and programs out in the field to watch it going in the ground, it should relay into lower maintenance costs down the road, as well as making sure that we're implementing the infrastructure in alignment with our master plans. So we're not building. My goal in life is to try not to add another lift station to Paul's list. Or if I do, I'm taking one or two off the list as we go. So with that, I know there's probably some discussion. I have a lot of stats that if you have questions, I can give. But I think real quick, I'll touch on the BDAB letter that was sent out to everybody. So we've been to BDAB, full BDAB twice, the advocacy group twice, to discuss this, discuss the increase in fees. So what we're having a pretty significant increase in the fees. On a project level, they're about 25% to 30% of cost, and that is to get everything back into alignment. So the private community and the business community just took that. They love that idea.
25% to 30% of what cost?
On the engineering fees. So if I needed to do a subdivision, and we looked at kind of planning engineering, you say, well, what fees do I need to pay to do a 25-lot subdivision, or a Walgreens, or a 100-unit apartment? On the engineering and planning fees, it's about 25% to 30% increase on the whole, because it's hard to take one fee and say, well, this fee's gone up 20%, this fee's gone up 10%, because we charge, there's a laundry list of fees we charge, from reviewing the plans to easement preparation to agreements and master plan development agreements that have to get created. So we kind of lump all these together and try to say, well, on the project level, what are we doing? Because that's really where the most significance is. So,
so we haven't been charging enough in fees? Is that what you mean? We're raising them by 25%?
Yes, because one, we needed to support the staffing that we really need to do the reviews. Our review times are stretching out, which is one of the metrics that we're concerned about. Sometimes it's taking us 6 weeks just to get to a first review on infrastructure plan, which is too long. But right now we have about 25 plans in review, and I have an engineer doing it. And the other engineers working on commercial permits that are coming in, because we look at all grading and drainage, right-of-way permits, dealing with franchises. So we just don't have the horsepower. And so once we did the fee study, looked at what their time allocations were, we identified the need for a couple additional engineers. We are basically 98% fee-based in our revenue structure. So we had to make those lines come back into alignment to make sure that the staffing needs met the revenue need for the staffing. And then my argument to BDAB and everybody else was, if you're telling me that I'm 95% fee-based, then just like the other funds with planning and building, then we better have a healthy reserve to keep our core people in place to ride the waves of the economy. Because one, we live with projects for literally 2 to 3 years. I think within CED, we spend the most time with them, because we're with them through initial napkin sketch when they come and say, I have an idea, all the way through planning, all the way through building, through infrastructure design and permitting, through their construction, acceptance, and their warranty period on their infrastructure, which is a year. So our group we're with these projects for 2 to 4 years as they go through. So we want to make sure that we have the staffing there to ride the waves.
So just a little bit of a reminder for Council of the Budget Committee, when we talked about this in April, one of the questions is, if you'd like to reduce the dependence on fees, so account for some of the general services, we've done some of that through our code, where we've taken, as Sharon listed off, there's certain services that we've said are funded by the general fund. The direction that we got at that financial retreat was, we wanted to continue to maintain this as a fee-based service. So that's what's reflected in the budget. But as I mentioned in the yesterday, kind of IDing the issues, that's what the Bend Economic Development Advisory Board, BDAP, has picked up on, is You know, I think there's still continued desire from the building and development community, business community in general, to account for those general services through, without trying to recapture that through fees.
Right. So basically, we have a lot of indirect costs. In order for us to issue a permit, we need to know basically everything that's going on in the city in terms of infrastructure and utility and street maintenance. So we sit in a lot of meetings, you know, SIAG, UGB, all the master plans. We're there. Because we have to implement these things when they're coming on, so we kind of want to know what they're doing.
Are you at all, I hope this isn't the stupidest question tonight, are you able to share inspector, building inspector with Mel? You know, is that just entirely different inspections that are going on? You know, because he does code inspection for building, right? Seems like there might be a little overlap there.
They're completely different. We run out of different books. So Mel's group works completely out of the building code, very strict and rigid requirements in there. We're running out of the standard specs that have been created specifically for BIN and our infrastructure. So we dictate what type of pipe you're going to use, what type of manholes you're going to use. It's a little bit out. It's apples and oranges.
But if we're looking at a driveway slab, the building inspector could potentially do that.
We could, and we've had conversations with the building department. The issues that we have is we actually explored that because we said, well, maybe there's synergy there where the building inspector is doing something.
He's already there anyway.
Right.
Yeah. The problem is typically when the driveways are poured on the house, his inspectors are not, there's not another concurrent building inspection where you have that good synergy. But we are always always exploring those possibilities and opportunities.
One thing that you mentioned is to keep down the number of inspectors that you have on staff, requiring of the private development that is a part of their expense, they pay for an inspector. Mm-hmm. I heard that correctly. That almost concerns me if the inspector feels they're working for the developer. Wouldn't there be a way for you to contract? Because they're going to go out and find an inspector and contract the inspection. Why couldn't the city do the same thing, have contract inspectors, and then the inspectors working for the city?
There, what we're relying on, to answer, you know, is the engineer that designed the project, we're basically asking him to provide a certification that the project was built accordingly. So we're using professional ethics in terms of how we're trying to monitor that. When we bring these inspectors in-house and they're outside, then we run into management issues with trying to keep them in the right spots. And then I'm also arguing with developers all the time over, well, you're charging me 20 hours for this inspector. I saw him out there for two. Other things happen as well. As soon as you put it back onto the private development side, we'll be monitoring. So in terms of when
it's not a free-for-all, there's still checkpoints that are inspectors, there's critical points of the project, as Russ mentioned.
And there's a litany of the requirements and the documentation they need to provide to us. And our inspectors are also going out at random intervals.
So they're liable.
That's what I was
going to
ask. Where's the liability?
So they, it's part of their profession.
We're going back.
Besides the ethics,
yeah. Right.
Financially liable.
Right.
I'm thinking of all the curb cuts that we're having to review.
Yeah, and so, I mean, like ADA ramps and everything, we get, one of the requirements is they provide the documentation that it was built correctly and it's certified. You know, we've got an engineer's kind of stamp saying, yep, we looked at it and it's built to your standard. The other thing that happens is we have no control over, on our side of the world, we have no control over the contractor that you choose or the schedule that they want to do. And when you push it back onto the private development community, all of a sudden the contractors and their engineers and their inspectors, they become a little bit more watchful of what's going on in terms of, I have this litany of requirements I need to provide the city in terms of as-built and compaction reports and testing reports and certifications. And we're gonna be looking tighter on our end. We're telling them, if it comes back and it's not right, you're ripping it out. Mm-hmm. And it's on you guys to figure out how you wanna work your team, but we're gonna make sure that we're getting what we need. There are certain times where our utility crews go out. They will camera the projects. They will do air testing. You know, we still do all the water testing to make sure it's safe. We'll be there anytime they tie into our system. I just don't need our inspectors, if we're laying
2,000 feet of 8-inch sewer line in a subdivision, I don't need to have our guys standing out there to make sure, you know, that full time to make sure that line's been put in right. But there are critical times like, no, our people will be there.
But if it's wrong, you know, it's on them to fix it.
Yep, exactly.
Actually, this is kind of a model of the aerospace industry where they build complicated things like airliners, and most of the inspectors, of which there are about as many people inspecting as there are actually building things, are paid for by the company. And then the feds come in just once in a while to make sure to keep the contracted inspectors in line to check on it from time to time. So I think it's a reasonable model, and it makes the accountability a little bit more clear.
Yeah.
I just didn't want it to come back on us.
Right.
No.
It does sound like the fox is guarding the hen.
In all honesty, right now it does, because we can't get our inspectors everywhere they need to be. We just don't have that crew, and we don't have the ability to ramp up and ramp down with projects and roll with the economy. So it's like, I need a core group of people that we have limited term people now that we brought in part time to help get us through this hump. And we always will have that ability that we can ramp up in the summer to provide some extra coverage if we need it. But to try to, over the long term, try to manage a program where, especially in construction, where I'm riding the ups and downs, it's really difficult, because if we get a winter, then all of a sudden I've got people that are helping with snow removal for months, right?
Russ?
Yeah?
Real quick question. Not that you have plenty of time to do studies like this, but has there been any comparison to cities about our size? The relationship between engineering inspectors and
We went out and we looked, and unfortunately we have apples, oranges, grapefruits, and pears.
Yeah.
trying to figure out how, because especially in the engineering world, everybody's structured differently. We looked at Corvallis and Gresham and Redmond, and we know from a fee base, from what we could gather, because everyone charges fees differently. In terms of, some of them say they just charge actual cost. And so trying to get a comparison back to, building that's easier because you can use building evaluations, but in terms of their requirements, and do they provide water and sewer and transportation, or do they have a water district and a sewer district? So we tried to reach out and try to figure that out. It was really hard to put something back together that was concrete. We do know from a fee base, from what we can gather, that with this increase, that we know that we're higher. But we also know that a lot of these other departments, they get some funding from the general fund as well, or they're just structured differently, where like our group would be housed into EIPD. So they would have review engineers doing review of private development, but also running a CIP project. I truly believe when you're in a town that is growing this fast, you can't do that. You need to have people dedicated to address the development community, because that's one of the things that came out during the last boom, was that engineering felt like a black hole. And that's because if you say that I have to run a $8 million CIP project or review a subdivision plan, I'm going to tell you I'm probably going to spend more time on this $8 million project, right? So I think the structure that the city has is the right structure in terms of keeping engineering within CDD, kind of directly related to CDD, and focusing on servicing the development community. Because I can tell you, all I do is talk. I talk to the developers, I talk to our utility groups, and because we're trying to figure out, we have a very complicated system, and trying to tell a developer exactly what they need to do so they can make a business decision on whether to go is probably one of the hardest things that we do.
Okay.
Related to that, I'm in favor of the program. I like the program, and I like how you have it structured. And with regard to the inspections, did you say that was the developers are providing their own inspections because it's cyclical, because of the winter weather, or is it really efficiency watching your own projects versus letting them look at their own smaller projects?
It's efficiency. So now we can direct our limited, our pool to, we've heard, and we're actually doing it now.
Are you doing the inspection over the CIP projects too, or
no,
just
not.
We're
coordinating with them, but we've heard that there's interest in, we don't like how the franchise utilities are cutting our streets, right? So we have a construction manager now that has been on board since the beginning of the year, and we are actively going after the franchise companies to make sure that they're that one, they're getting permits, and two, they're doing the same track that they're supposed to.
Well, maybe this is a question maybe for Mel. Would that translate to the building inspections as well?
No.
Whereas, because you have winter weather cyclical nature, I'm just asking the question.
I don't know. Building can run year round.
I mean, I know there's interior construction, yeah. So I was just wondering if that was.
So typically, we, you know, with building, you can feel it. It's like, I need to get out of the ground by November so I can continue construction.
Got it. Interior. Got it. Yeah. One other question was, you're referring to the BDAP letter. I haven't seen the BDAP letter. I don't know. It went to council.
We'll email it to everybody on the budget committee.
Okay. Was it essentially the same old comment?
The same thing that we got with planning.
Public is getting, the general public's getting benefit from this, so why isn't some of it?
Carolyn, you want to?
Sorry. So I think the business community, so I'm staff to the city's economic development board, so the business community's been squawking about fees forever, you know, for as long as any of you have been sitting around this table, they've been complaining about fees. And one of the real charges of creating the BDAB and the business advocate position was to try to improve that relationship, largely, to try to figure out, get to the bottom of it. And what we found, the BDAB commented on the planning fee study, and we said, listen, the development community, the builders, whatever, they're fine paying for the service that they get from Mel's group or Colin's group. But when they start having to pay for service they don't get, so if Russ is sitting through hours and hours of OSU meetings and not reviewing right-of-way permits, they're saying, why am I paying the fee to review the right-of-way permit and the additional 25% that needs to cover Russ's ability to go to the OSU meetings? And so it's a little bit like, if you paid Ben Broadband for this really high-level service and you only got this low-level service, and the only way you could get the low-level service is if you paid for the really fast service. And so I think the development community is saying, we're fine. I mean, we agree with the work, not even the development community, I think the larger business community, because we've heard from the development community for years, and this is where the business community, the tech community, Geldwin, are looking at these fees and saying, we are fine with setting the fees at the cost of service. No problem. If it's going to get me a right-of-way permit faster, excellent. But what I'm not crazy about is paying for a fee that covers the work that Kyle and Russ and Nikolai are doing for the water and sewer utility, or for the street utility, or for the other overhead that's associated with providing general service. And so I think that the goal really of the letter is to just sort of bring the conversation to the surface. Because as we continue to, when you look to see where we're collecting funds from the water utilities or from the private utilities, from the garbage utilities, some of that's being allocated to the places where it needs to be, and others of it isn't really being necessarily directed to the service that's being provided. And you talk with Tom Hickman and the sewer utility, he's like, yeah, but that would mean raising the sewer rate another 0.25%, and there's not appetite for that if we want to really provide funding for that service. So that's largely the
So how about, are they looking for a general fund subsidy, or how much is it, or what's their solution?
So the proposal from the BDAB in the letter is that the fee should be set to cover about 60% of what they're proposed to be. So right now the fees are set to cover 100% of what Russ's $1.4 million budget plus the reserve, so almost $2.1 million. So the fees are set at 100% to cover that, all of that revenue that needs to come in, and they said we'd really be comfortable if those fees were set to cover 60%.
But the question is the same question, whether it's these fees, planning fees, building fees, is you have cost A, which is the cost for the service, and cost B, which is the what they would consider ancillary, not directly related to the service, and where does that come from?
Absolutely.
And it comes back to, is it a general fund?
Absolutely. I'm not saying that there's an answer to the question. I'm just saying what the BDAB is proposing.
I know, you had that debate two years ago.
I just want to make sure that that was the same.
When this was the planning department, we did half it, right?
But we had a lot of discussion, and you and I really were on different sides of that discussion. I remember it clearly because, and it comes back to how James really framed it, which is
is it appropriate? I mean, they are services that you have to have provided in order for these people who are doing these projects to move forward, in order for those projects to move forward, right? And the question
and the argument is that that other 40%, the general public is benefiting from this work additionally, in addition. And so therefore, should they pay some of that?
That wasn't the only argument. The argument was a lot of people use the counter, use planning services.
Yeah.
They have a question or something needs to be
done. Everything else is in that 40%
of it, right?
But in this particular case, isn't it, and I think Carolyn said, that some of this is about inspections for the sewer projects and for the water project and for street projects. And those have their own funds. So if one is worried about this aspect of the private developers paying too much fees that are not related to their projects, then shouldn't those other funds be transferring into Russ's funds?
I think one argument, and Russ touched on it a little bit, is that these engineers used to live in those utilities, and the work.
Yeah, so that's even a better argument for those utilities helping to pay Russ, not just that they changed the locations.
Yeah, and I think I want to be clear: the letter from the BDAB is general. We don't have 2 years of data to tell you that Russ and Kyle and Nikolai spent 17% of their time on the sewer utility and 3% of their time on the water. I mean, we don't know that.
Where's the 60%?
Yeah, where'd that come from?
So I don't know. Do you have your triangle?
I don't have a triangle, but what it ran into is I do have the numbers here. So, the triangle.
Like the little bell to raise attention.
So when you look at the entire fee structure. You break it out, about 54-55% of what we're charging goes directly to what us reviewing the plans or providing a service on their project. About 34% of it goes to indirect costs, 34-35% goes indirect, which is administration, overhead, lights, building, normal business costs, but also in order for us to be able to issue that permit, we also have to have all this institutional knowledge to say, well, if you're going to build here, then you need to go tie into that sewer station and build that road, and there's SDC credits over here, and that project's going on, you need to wait, you can go in 2 years, all that needs to happen, and that's kind of that indirect cost of us just being able to gather all that information and collect that information, so whoever, whether it's someone with their septic tank or someone who wants to do OSU walks in the door, we can say, this is exactly what you need to do. Because we get questions on, they range. In a day, literally, I answer a question, can I hook my septic up to this sewer line, to, I want to do a large scale master plan development, what do I need to build?
Just to clarify out of Jim's question, so.
So for Russ's position as the city engineer, he is the one position in that department that is funded from a couple of different places. So his position is directly funded a third out of this private development engineering, a third out of CIP engineering, so Tom Hickman's budget. And then his other third is funded by the utilities, which is then like a third, a third, a third, water, sewer, storm. So Russ's position as the city engineer
isn't all
fee.
And that's already taken out of what is shown in the budget.
The last point you made about institutional knowledge or memory is really important from owning a utility company myself. In the past, I've seen the city, years ago when that anti-growth crowd kind of took control and they set this, we're going to make everybody, the developers, pay for this, everything on their own. It was really, truly a very failed model in the sense that we can look at all the ADA ramps around town, and if you want to talk about the general fund having some liability later because of how many millions of dollars have we spent on ADA ramps thus far? And that was your department, if properly staffed and organized and set up, could very well have prevented that debacle from happening in the first place. And that's worth tens of millions into that, I'm sure, if we're a dollar. So it's a bunch of money, whatever the case. Aside from the fact that impediments to growth in terms of people being able to process their permits, effectively and quickly. Don't go too hard on the franchise utilities, they're nice guys.
No,
I'm happy to see this department get its due and get recognition and support from the general fund, because certainly that's what the Economic Development Advisory Board is advocating for, is that the importance to the city in its, in the long term and its ongoing consideration of the maintenance of its assets, so we're not creating these problems later, whether it's street cuts from franchise utilities who have historically done a very poor job and really have truly run roughshod for years and years and years, to private development engineers when those have been. So I think you're absolutely on the right track, and I'm looking forward to supporting this for sure.
So what I tell our staff is our goal is that in 10, 15 years, we don't want to be right back here with another $80 million sewer CFD. That's our goal, right? We're in track with the master plan. Everybody's turning the right direction, and we've got our infrastructure needs under control. And hopefully at some point we can become a more plug and play city where every development proposal that comes in is not 20 issues that we need to resolve. Mm-hmm. It's very complicated, especially in certain parts of town. Fred Meyer's in the north end is a perfect example of there's a major sewer problem up there and a major transportation problem. And right now, you know, my staff and everybody, we spent countless hours trying to figure this out, and we haven't gotten a land use application. So that time you will never recover, no matter what you charge in fees, but it's a service that we need to be here to provide to help, you know, serve for economic development and just, you know, the goals of the city of what we want to achieve. That's why we're here.
An advisory board saying we're happy to pay our costs. That they're absolutely saying that. We're happy to pay our costs. However, we can't be heaping the public's general benefit on the backs of, because those costs don't go to developers' profits. They go right into the cost of the building. So this whole thing about, we're going to stick it to developers, well, you're sticking it to people trying to buy the house, right? I mean, that's, we have to get past that.
For me, I think, I have been for a long time totally convinced that what Russ's department doing is absolutely critical to the future of our city. But I still haven't heard the argument why that ought to be subsidized by the general fund as opposed to subsidized by water and sewer and street funds.
How much are we talking about here? What's the figure? What's the
so, it's 2.1 million minus 65,000, 60%. Yeah. So the difference there.
50% would be $1 million.
Yeah, it's less than
that.
I think it's, if you're looking at the truth, it's like $400,000 or $500,000.
A year.
Yeah.
So $1 million a biennium.
To help kind of on that indirect cost, because we have transfers to, you know, just general city and administration, so it's, you know, how you want to break those buckets up. But that indirect cost typically was turning out to be, you know, about $500,000. And I don't think it's that full cost, you can say, some of that is an indirect cost to a permit that's related to a permit, right? For us, just add lights on.
And that's where you saw the BDEP come up with 60. I mean, they were sort of trying to say, like, pay for it. We're totally fine paying for the cost of the service that we get, and we're fine paying. If you do some work with DEA, you get the service, and then you pay DEA's overhead. I mean, so they recognize that there's overhead associated with any service that you provide. So there was no, so 60% was sort of.
Did BDEF come up with any suggestions as to where to find the other funds?
Yeah, so they listed out three real.
Rather than just saying we don't like this?
But this is where I feel like we're moving the conversation a little bit further than we've ever come before. And maybe this is just a try and we'll see where it goes. But it is the utilities, so we know that that's the franchise fees. So we do collect franchise fees from private utilities. We do allocate the garbage, it goes right to streets, and then water and sewer goes back to the construction funds. So we saw that yesterday evening. But the private utilities are allocated 100% to the general fund. And then the general service, so some of that's already captured because the that general fund subsidy, that $65,000, is going to the pre-applications. But there's other general service that the department provides beyond the pre-application. So that's where we chose those three areas.
So as soon as, if we knew that, you know, there is a steady source of funding coming in from other sources, then the reserves drop as well, you know, so it's kind of this ancillary, it kind of goes, the reserve requirements and outside funding go hand in hand. Just, you know, too, some of the comments we get that we're concerned about is, you know that you're, what the fee you're going to charge or possibly charge may cost more than the actual improvement that, that we're going to have to build. That's where I get worried. Or I'm charging more for you guys to review the plans than I'm charging the engineer to design them.
Exactly.
And you know, those kind of, those are the kind of those balanced tipping points that we want to be sensitive to.
So just to kind of wrap this up, this is the, this is it for the night, and we're just about 10 minutes over past nine. Do you want to provide some direction right now, or do you want to wait and really see this in conjunction with the general fund tomorrow, and you can make some decisions at that point?
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah.
How much of a can of worms would it be to try and tease out where we should be doing interfund transfers to your department?
Yeah, we could, you know, I don't know if we have, this might be something we would bring back to.
Yeah.
I don't know if we can, the turnaround time.
I mean,
to
that
do it
one
tomorrow.
Sounds like a
so
definite.
Maybe
okay,
if that's
to pull
the direction
that
where you want to look at kind of a mix of utilities, and, you know, take some of these recommendations and put them into some action. We're not going to be able to just turn that out by tomorrow, but
well,
we could.
But that's
we could,
the question
that's
in
the,
my mind. As
maybe
far
that's
as
the direction that we could say yes, we're interested in looking at providing some additional revenue sources beyond just a straight fee. If that's, if it's as simple as that,
yeah,
it makes it more equitable.
Yeah,
it speaks to BDAP's concerns.
It's really about sort of connecting the service with the cost of service with the fees.
Yeah.
In a little more precise fashion.
Mm-hmm. Sharon, what do you? I mean, we can come back to council in a few weeks with that, and we can probably try to figure that out and provide some recommendations before the budget.
Yeah, when the budget gets adopted.
Yeah.
This is pretty fresh for tonight, and it's.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. We would leave the budget as is for right now, and what we would do is take this direction and put it into. We would try to get something in front of you before the budget gets adopted in June to give us a few weeks to kind of work through a recommendation. So that we are thoughtful and don't do this kind of meager.
And I think the other part of Russ's story that struck me that could cause us to stop and think is when companies like Fred Meyer, Megacorp, Kroger, comes in and wants to have all this special attention and information and knowledge and analysis, and then they end up not doing their project, and you're kind of left holding the bag. You provide all these services, but nothing happens. It didn't result in a program. Mm-hmm. Right. And who? How should that be accounted for cost-wise?
And part of that response to that, too, is that our systems are so convoluted that I feel it's part of the city's responsibility to be able to provide a fair response back to them. Because they're, a lot of times they're waiting for us to tell them, just tell me what I need to do so I can make a business decision. And we have to spin for a while to figure out, because I mean, literally, it came in, discussions about the North Interceptor popped up.
But when they hire a consultant and land use attorneys and stuff to investigate related questions, they have to pay a lot for that, but when they do it to the city, then they're getting the free ride. So there are different ways to think about it, but something to analyze. And I totally agree, if we knew how that would fit, if we had a model like with the sewer and the transportation system, we would plug it in the numbers and get an answer in 15 minutes.
Great.
That would be great.
Get that figured out for us tomorrow, please.
So
We're just chatting because we had planned to bring a fee resolution in front of council to kind of walk through all the fees on your work session on the 20th. Actually, really the biggest change in fees.
It's time to go home.
Anyways, so maybe what we might do is delay that fee resolution and come back to you on June 3rd. Just give us two more weeks, and that'll give us some more time to kind of really give you some recommendations on the fees and what the impacts. If you're changing kind of the revenue stream coming in, it'll alter the fees. So maybe we'll do that, which is fine, because we're actually pretty packed on the 20th anyways.
We can bring some relevant project examples.
But we'll try to. Yeah.
Can I just have a brief process question? So the formal adoption of this budget is scheduled for when?
Formal is the second meeting in June.
June 17th.
June 17th. So basically between tomorrow night and June 17th, if
we had ideas about it, just by kind of after the fact, after going through this, when would be the appropriate time?
Well, if June 3rd, in the, I think what we'll, in my head, I'm thinking out loud here, so, is that on June 3rd, in the work session, we'll talk about impact. We'll give you some, I think that might be the opportunity to kind of have a more of a discussion around some of these recommendations, get some direction from council at the work session. The formal action would take place on the 17th.
Okay, and then just discussion on the 3rd, does that include the whole budget committee or just the city?
Well, that it typically is the cap, but we'll invite the budget committee to attend that, so they're welcome to report
that. Isn't it true that if the council chooses to change the budget in some significant way, I don't know what the criteria are, but if it does, then it has to reassemble
formal. We'll be okay.
We're fine with this, it's 10%, but as a courtesy and because of all the involvement and stuff, we will make sure that we invite the budget committee to that work session so you can hear along with us.
Okay. And then we were going to also have a presentation about the possible gas tax on
the 20th.
So should the budget committee going to be part of
that? Budget committee can come anytime that they want. I mean, otherwise we're going to have 14 people on the dais for the next two meetings. That might be a lot. So I think just their participation in the audience, and if there's opportunities for them to comment too, public comment, that kind of thing, I think that's fine. But I don't know. It's not an official budget committee meeting where it's noticed as such.
Right.
We'll just, when we have big budgetary items, we typically notice the budget committee. Okay.
So, last comment by the vice chair. You've noticed that our chair is irresponsible and has left to be with his wife on the sandwich. And so, the last thing was going to be sharing a roundtable discussion for 30 seconds. If anybody wants to say anything, now's the time. Otherwise, I'll adjourn us.